Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
Whiskey Congress is back in session. Pretty much recording this, and we'll be publishing this in real time, so we've got that going for us, which is nice. We're once again doing this on Zoom. So the quarantine remains affecting our lives. I actually went out the other day and had a beer on a patio in the pouring rain, which felt amazing. I don't know if you saw it on Facebook, but I was literally like, it was raining all around me. It looked like a scene from the movie Seven, with me out there alone on a patio, happily sucking down a beer. And we got to start with some politics stuff. So obviously, Trump is still bragging about his performance for dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. And of course, now not only is he talking about a great job he did, but apparently, all this blame falls on Obama.
It's interesting. He threw out Obamagate. I think part of that was in response to what was going on with General Flynn. A lot of people are trying to turn the situation with him into something much more than it is. William Barr, the Attorney General, kind of swooped in at the last second to say that the Department of Justice was just going to drop the charges after Flynn had already pled guilty and had pled that he knew that lying to the FBI was a federal crime. And that really threw the world of criminal justice and federal criminal procedure for a loop. After a person admits to a crime, you don't just say, all right, you know what, we're going to drop the charges because we really like him because he's on our team. And so there was some concern there from a political standpoint and from really a legal standpoint on what this could mean potentially. And the judge has stepped in and has decided that it's not going to go down quite that way. He's brought in another judge. And I mean, this will be an ongoing thing. And what it sounds like is the judge is probably going to not let the DOJ pull the charges. The plea is going to stand, and then he'll either appeal it, and I'm assuming that Trump will just kind of save all that and just pardon him. Trump has the pardon power; it's in the Constitution. And if they wanted to get him off, that's how they should have done it. This whole thing of the DOJ swooping in and dropping the charges was ridiculous. Now, what Trump is trying to do is, distract from this COVID-19 situation. You've got close to 90,000 people dead, if not 90,000 people. You've got millions of infections across the country. And, the United States is the epicenter of this. Now, I think, Trump's taking a little heat because he's saying, if you test more, you'll get more, you'll have more positive tests. And I think he was saying that in criticisms of some of the countries that are not releasing real numbers, like India, like Russia, and some of your bad faith actors when it comes to situations like this. But the reality is while yes, the United States has tested more people than anybody else, we have 350 million people, and we've tested 7 million, so that's a drop in the bucket. We're still at a low percentage of tests when you do it in relation to the population. So where Obama comes into this, the Trump administration, his new press secretary, was Kelly McEnany, and all the Trump surrogates are saying, well, Obama didn't prepare them for the pandemic. He didn't replenish the stockpiles of N95 masks and PPE. And he didn't give them the necessary information on how to deal with this during the transition. Now, Obama administration comes out and says, look, we gave you a 70-page manual on what to do during a pandemic, everything from, you know, replenishing the PPE stockpiles and, you know, how to deal with your communications and everything else. We literally handed it to you and told you, you know, read it before it happens and then reread it, break glass in case of emergency. Which at that point, you know, Mitch McConnell had come out and said that there was no manual given and they weren't prepared and it's all Obama's fault. And then Mitch McConnell had to come out and say, well, they did give a manual. I wasn't aware of that. So, you know, I have to eat my own shit. You know, and now the Trump administration is spinning it saying, well, Obama did give us a manual on how to deal with it, but we didn't think it was suffice enough. So we updated it, and now we're doing it our way, and look how great everything is turning out. And it's just, it's really predictable. You know, on Twitter, I think I said that you just, at this point, you know what their playbook is. It's kind of the cross between, you know, a funny parody movie and dealing with an obnoxious, you know, frat boy college kid, right? Like, they're going to do something bad, and they're going to lie to get their way out of it, and they're going to blame somebody else, and then they're going to tell you that everything that they're doing is great. Right? That is literally what they're going to do. You can put it in a bad movie. You know that obnoxious kid that you deal with who acts like that. And that it's just, and it's no matter what, if something goes wrong, they're going to deny that it's wrong, and then they're going to blame somebody else, and then they're going to tell you that everything they're doing is right, and it's all great, even though the world is on fire. You know, right behind them as they're saying. So, you know, that's where we're at with this. You know, the individual governors, some are doing a really good job. Some are not doing a great job. There's heat all around. I've written an article about this. I'm going to produce it. It'll be out, it'll be out first thing Monday morning for people to read. But it'll talk about where we are with the coronavirus and kind of what to expect and how, you know, maybe some answers we should be looking for.
So we've talked time and again about the willingness of Trump's supporters to ignore realities and, you know, spin things, take whatever comes out of his mouth as gospel, whatever. There has to come a point where even his staunch supporters go, you can't blame the guy who was there 3 years ago and claimed that you were on top of this the whole time and keep a straight face. You know, is there any point at which his followers will abandon him? The answer is probably no.
No, I mean, but we know that they are in it for the long haul. I've said this time and time again. This is less about Trump and this is more about what Trump represents for his firm believers and followers. For the people in the media, whether it's your Fox Nation people or Sean Hannity or Breitbart, for them, it's about money, right? The more Trump and the more controversy around Trump, the more clicks, the more views, and the more things that they get. So they're going to continue to stir the pot. They're going to continue to support him through it because they know the value that it brings, right? And then for the people just out in the street, regular, you know, Tom, Dick, and Harry, for them, it's, again, it's about what Trump represents. Trump doesn't represent, you know, minorities rising up. He doesn't represent minorities on TV. He doesn't represent, you know, black people leveling the playing field. He doesn't represent Mexicans coming into the country and all that stuff. He represents the opposite of that, right? He pushes back against all that. He represents keeping black people in their place and treating, you know, young black men like criminals and thugs unless they're, you know, MAGA hat wearing, you know, proper English speaking, you know, Trump supporters, then black people need to know what their place is under Trump. And, you know, we're not going to have any more Mexican immigrants coming into the country illegally because he's building a wall. Like, he represents a feeling and a movement, and so they will always support him because they feel that he is a center part of that movement. So it doesn't matter all this other stuff, right? They'll even admit, like, yeah, he lies, but that's fine because if you don't worry about what he says, it's about what he does, and the things that he's doing are what we want to be done.
Well, again, this is just
And this is what, it's mind blowing. It's sad, you know, as a person who, you know, studied political science and economics in college, as a person, you know, who went to law school and really, you know, studied the Constitution and other aspects of law and our civic culture and makeup. It's sad to see what's happening. There's a lot of people that after this are going to have to continue to look themselves in the mirror and recognize what they've done to our country and what we stand for. You know, I firmly believe that William Barr has, I mean, he after this, if I were the head of any bar association that he's a part of, I would move that he lose his license. Like, that's how bad he's been. And this isn't about politics. It's just about what he's done in the public eye with our legal system is a catastrophe.
And he's the highest ranking person in the Department of Justice.
Exactly. I mean, and there's a number of people like him that are going around supporting some of the things that Trump's saying and this administration is trying to do. And those people know that it's bullshit. They know that they're trying to do it just to, you know, make sure that, you know, take out any sort of roadblock for Trump to make sure that he gets reelected so we get another 4 years of him. You know, there was even a story where Jared Kushner came out and said that, you know, depending on the coronavirus, well, we're not sure if we'll have an election. You know, we don't know if
right.
That'll go. We may have to delay it. Which it's not up to the administration to decide that. I mean, that rests directly on Congress and the states. So it's just crazy to see some of the things that are being said and done in the name of Trump. And to be fair, it's brought out some really ugliness, some really ugly, shitty behavior on the other side. You know, I mean, I think some people feel that in order to beat Trump, you have to be willing to go as low as him, if not lower, even though they believe they have the moral high ground. You're seeing some people on the left that are really kind of corrupt with themselves as well, that unfortunately have to be called out and have to be questioned. But the reality is, for this shit show to be over, we need people to show up and vote and get him out, right? I mean, I think he's just bad for the union. He's bad for the country. He's really just bad for everyone all around. And even when he's out, he's still going to be a problem because, you know, he's still going to have his staunch followers. People are going to listen to him. He's going to try to influence things. I'm sure he's going to try to take over a network, OANN or whatever, and turn it into Trump TV. And he's always going to have once he's out of office, he can always say that he was president of the United States. And unfortunately, there's nothing you can do to change that. So he will have some voice and some influence, and he's not going to be like George W. Bush and sit back and go away.
Well, I mean, Obama had remained relatively quiet for the longest time, despite being trashed constantly by Trump. And now he's starting to make himself heard. And I think from a making Joe Biden popular standpoint, the more Barack Obama we get, the more people are going to think highly of Biden as a candidate, even if maybe they shouldn't. So I think by trying to drag Obama through the mud, Trump might be making a very poor political long-term decision, but time will tell on that.
Yeah, I mean, and Obama, I think Obama has been relatively quiet. I mean, he's definitely taken some jabs at Trump for some of Trump's behavior and actions, which is out of character for most presidents. But I mean, Trump is out of character completely for most presidents. And so I think Obama has a responsibility there. And, you know, this latest dust up, you know, I think Obama was speaking to a group of his former employees in a semi-private setting and, you know, was critical of Trump, and that got out, which just kind of goes to show you, like, you just can't, you know, you can't trust anybody, you know, during this time, I mean, between all the gadgets and the phones and the recording devices and everything else, and the need for people to get messages out with so many different platforms, you know that there's really very little that you can say when you have that big of a spotlight on you that's not going to get heard around the world.
Right. So, you know, early on in the Trump administration, people would say, you know, Jared Kushner, we never hear from him. Why don't we ever hear from Jared Kushner? Now that we hear from him, he's not scoring any points. I mean, like you said, he can't, the administration can't change an election date. You can't. So yeah, maybe Jared should go back to shutting up.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think we were, honestly, I think Jared Kushner was way too involved from the get-go. I mean, the guy, it was inherits or is the heir or whatever to a crappy real estate company that's made a lot of money as slumlords, basically, on the East Coast. And the Trump administration decides that they're going to put him in charge of peace in the Middle East. And then he puts together some crappy offer that fails miserably, and they keep giving him these monumental tasks. But I think they do it for a reason, specifically because they know that he's not going to get any traction. Nothing's going to happen. It'll be a dust up in the news for a quick minute, and it'll go away. It gives him something to do. It gives them the ability to say, look, we tried. It just didn't work. And either blame Kushner or blame the other parties for it not working. And then you put him out there, you let him say something stupid like this, like, oh, well, maybe we'll just postpone the election. And again, he takes heat and it takes pressure off the Trump administration.
Where do you stand on the vote by mail thing? Because it seems to be a pretty strong push by the Trump crowd not to allow voting by mail.
Well, anything that makes voting easier is bad for Republicans. Everybody knows it. And so they're gonna push against it. And the way that they're gonna push against it is say that it creates the ability for more fraud, that there, you know, multiple ballots will be sent to, you know, the same person, and then you'll have one person filling out 20 ballots, all for Democrats, and that it you know, it leads to voter fraud, and that's how the Democrats will steal the election. You know, on the Democratic side, it's one, you have the coronavirus going on. Do we really want people in line in voting booths? Do we want to take a situation that, you know, we just saw in the midterms down in Texas, people were waiting until midnight, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning to get a vote in. Do we really want to see that situation made even worse by, you know, having to implement social distancing and, you know, a line that was, you know, a block down the road now goes a mile down the road because of social distancing and everything else. So, you know, there's some legitimate concerns on how do we do this if we don't have a vaccine, we don't have a treatment, and we see a resurgence in the virus coming in the fall, which there are people who study this who say it very well could happen. Where do I stand? I mean, I voted by mail. We've had voting by mail. Absentee ballots, you know, that's what an absentee ballot is voting by mail. I mean, we've had it for the longest time. I think it really is, the push against it is, are there some concerns about, should there be concerns about fraud? Maybe. You know, maybe a fraction of a percent that there will be some, you know, rogue resistance, you know, fighter out there that thinks that, you know, they're pulling a fast one, and, you know, maybe you account for that to some degree, but I don't think it's, I really don't think that it's this giant scam that's going to, you know, net an automatic Democratic victory.
All right. I just think that the protests against it make very little sense to me because, like you said, we've had absentee ballots for years. You know, for the party that always claims that they want to support the military and their rights, you know, overseas balloting from military families has been a part of every election of my lifetime. So I don't know why it was okay then and it's not okay now, other than, like you said, anything that makes voter suppression difficult
What's also funny is that, so Trump voted by mail.
What?
Trump voted by mail in the last election because he's a resident of Florida. And someone called
in New York?
Yeah, no, he was in D.C. in the midterms. Oh, okay. Just passed.
Okay.
You know, I mean, like, so he voted by mail and a reporter said, well, you voted by mail. He's like, well, it's because I can't. And I'm in the White House, so it's fine. Right, like I'm not going to commit voter fraud. We all know it, so it's fine. But you know, those nefarious Mexicans and those nefarious do nothing Democrats, you know that they're going to cheat. So they can't be doing what I'm doing. I'm fine.
I didn't know that you said that. Wow.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Actually, it's kind of par for the course now. All right. We will see how things unfold, but I would like to see us make an effort to make voting by mail that much more easy and prevalent, because, you know, getting people out to the polls is going to be more challenging this year than usual years, potentially anyway. We talked about Ahmaud Arbery last week, and there's a case that's kind of getting called into, it's getting called a parallel, though there's really not a whole lot of similarities, but a woman named Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky, was in her apartment. Police executed a no-knock warrant, busted the door in. Her boyfriend was with her in the apartment. He responded to someone breaking in by shooting at the people who broke in, who happened to be police, who he says he acted in self-defense. Police ended up firing over 20 shots, which included killing Breonna Taylor. The way it got handled after that makes it even worse, because her mom was trying to reach her. Mom was told to go to the local hospital, where she was under the impression that Breonna was being treated. She had actually not yet left she was deceased and still in the apartment when the mother was at the hospital waiting. And now her boyfriend, a man named Kenneth Walker, who, again, longtime boyfriend, but did not reside in the same building, is being charged with attempted murder. He's claiming self-defense. Obviously I don't know what you need to do to get a no-knock warrant, but this seems like a very avoidable situation. And Kenneth Walker being charged with attempted murder, I think, is based on what I know. I should be fair, but it sounds to me like it said in the article I read that he was a licensed, he was licensed to have a firearm. Now that term gets used and misused a lot, but if he had a concealed carry permit and he was inside a home and someone entered the home and didn't announce themselves, I don't see how it's not a self-defense case.
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple things too. I mean, there was a police officer who was shot, and the police were initially attributing that gun wound to Kenneth Walker, but it seems like it was probably friendly fire from one of the other officers. I mean, these officers were just, I mean, they put rounds through her apartment that went into other apartments where she was living. And a no-knock warrant, I've had an issue with these, since I was working at the public defender's office in Chicago. This is not the main reason why, but I mean, this is a result of what could happen. The police, what they do is in order to secure a no-knock warrant, they have to basically explain to the judge that they believe that the people on premises are dangerous and that there's a high probability that they will try to dispose of evidence. If the police announce themselves, they say things like that they have cameras and microphones, and that if the police announce themselves, that it gives the people inside the home, the suspects that they're looking for, gives them an opportunity to get rid of drugs, and often they run, which makes it harder to, get evidence. And if they run and they get away, then, they may not get an opportunity to, get that suspect and bring them to custody. And it seems like a good argument, for in the name of justice and things like that, but you issue a no-knock warrant, bust in, yeah, you catch people off guard, you catch them by surprise. But even if you were dealing with drug dealers and people that you were thinking that were doing some of the things that you would suspect them of doing, a lot of times, like, these people are armed, right? And so you catch an armed person by surprise and you bust their door in, then, I mean, I'm not sure that your situation is any better, because they may think that you're a rival whoever, busting in, and they shoot back. So I'm not sure how you made that situation any better. And so, you know, you have a person who was in a home who, like you said, was licensed. We're assuming that means concealed carry, who was caught by surprise by someone busting in the door. And, you know, he fires back. And so I think, especially in a state like Kentucky, where, you know, gun laws are, you know, like people's ability to defend themselves with the gun are highly valued, you would think that they would look at that and say, listen, he is acting like a reasonable person in this situation. Someone busts your door in, then, you know, you're not thinking that they're there to borrow sugar.
He was not the target of the warrant. In fact, I think you told me that the guy who was the target of the warrant was not in the house and had already been
detained. The guy that they were looking for had been detained prior to them even arriving at her house. Right. So he had been detained earlier that evening, which, I mean, again, it's just like, it goes to, why was that not communicated to these people? You know, to these police officers, to this team, Rose McGowan.
Bill Maher I was trying to do that behind the scenes.
How are you doing it behind the scenes? You just put it on the camera.
Yeah, I know, but people won't be seeing this. Anyway, we talked about Rose McGowan accusing Bill Maher. We forgot to put it on the list of things to talk about.
Okay. I think you could have just added it and said, hey, I forgot. But anyway, I think when it comes to Breonna Taylor, the other thing is that this happened in March. It's now the end of May.
March.
And I think that's the parallel between Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor, is that you have two, you know, seemingly unjust killings of Black people, and it takes, you know, months to get any sort of attention and for, you know, anything to be done. The officers, you know, none of the officers have been charged or arrested. I believe three of the officers have been, you know, moved to different divisions or something along those lines, or have different assignments. They say it's under investigation, but who knows what that means, especially when you're dealing with police. And so maybe that's your parallel, because the situations are vastly different. And what's really sad is that Breonna Taylor did absolutely nothing here, right? I mean, as far as we know, there was a warrant. The warrant was for her home, because the person that was apprehended, they said they had seen going in and out of her home. The assumption was that the person that they were looking for was keeping drugs and money at her place. So they were going there, you know, hoping to catch him there and to find drugs and money. And they didn't find either. And you have this situation that unfolded. It's just really sad that this girl lost her life for all of this. And who knows what was going on? You know, maybe the guy was stashing money there. Maybe, you know, so maybe they just caught it on an off night where there was no money or something along those lines. Or he got wind that the police were closing in. Or, you know, maybe she was just sleeping with the guy. Maybe she was, you know, I mean, because she was an EMT, she was a nurse. There doesn't seem to be any issues with her. But, you know, this guy that they were looking for, who knows, maybe she wasn't the perfect angel and she was sleeping with two guys or whatever. Or maybe the guy and Kenny Walker were friends or something along those lines. Who knows? But what we do know is that there's no way she deserved to lose her life. Right? She hadn't committed a crime that we know of or anything to it. And she doesn't even seem to fit the bill as a person who would have any involvement in any of this. So who knows what that relationship was. But it's just really sad. And because of the coronavirus, I don't even know if there was a funeral for her or anything along those lines. And it's just a really awful situation, especially the way her mother had to find out. And now this Kenny Walker person is facing, you know, these really serious charges. And it just doesn't seem justified. And this just seems really unfair. And, you know, there's I was talking to you about a certain level of fatigue with this stuff. I mean, why are Black people so angry? Why do we get so mad? Why do you see protests in the streets? It's because, you know, bad things happen to us that aren't fair, that aren't justified. And we don't need national attention. We're not necessarily, CNN doesn't have to cover every black person that gets murdered. We prefer if it wasn't spread all over TV and shared all over the internet. The problem is that you have something just so terrible that happens and nothing happens, right? Like the state, the city, the local places where these things happen, it's just like, well, sucks for you and your family, but you know, no one will miss you. You know, like it's just like we get killed in the middle of the street, we get killed in our own home, and the police don't care, the prosecutors don't care, nothing happens, no one goes to jail, no one gets dragged into court, no one else gets their family ripped apart. We're just left to pick up the pieces over and over and over again. And that's the hard part, right? Like we're not asking for retribution for a white person, like for every black person that's killed unjustly. A white person needs to be killed. No, that's not what we're asking for. That's insane. No, what we're asking for is, like, if it was unjust, then that person needs to be brought to justice, right? If this were a white girl that was killed in her apartment, like, the entire country would be up in fucking arms. You know, I mean, if it was a white kid, a white 25-year-old kid who was a nice enough guy, you know, people would be seriously pissed about it. You know, and those two guys would fucking be in jail. You know, I mean, like, so it happens, crime happens, that we get it. But the part that sucks is when it happens to us, it gets swept under the rug. You know, and that's the part that needs to change.
Well, and I think that's what I, you know, you're going to call me for white explaining here, but that's when there's no due process and there's no, you know, equal use of the justice system. I think that's the main cause of the frustration, right? That you're...
That's what I said.
This doesn't work. Okay. All right. This is a perfect example of if we had body cams on the cops, we'd know a whole lot more. And if they wanted to justify...
I mean, that's the other part of it, too. This particular police force or whatever, this task force or whatever, when they do no-knock warrants... Part of that is they don't wear body cams.
Because
I don't know. They don't give a justification for it. Okay. Obviously. But I mean they made that very clear. When someone from their team was interviewed and they stated that, you know, no knock warrants, you know, part of it is that they don't wear body cams. That seems like a terrible precedent. I mean, like you have the technology, you know, it's been, you know, however many years since Ferguson and all that other stuff. I mean, it should be, you know, pretty commonplace to, you know, especially if you're going to have a situation like if for anything that you're going to have a body cam for, it seems like this is the thing that you would want them to be wearing body cams for. I mean, for them, for their own reasons, right? Like this is
why.
I mean, like, look, I mean, you know, you go busting in a door and you get shot at. And, you know, because they've gone back and the police have also gone back and said, oh, yeah, we did announce ourselves. Like, so why would you announce yourselves if you have a no-knock warrant that we have on file? Right. Like, well, like, so you changed your mind all of a sudden. You did want to announce yourself at midnight when you were busting in the door of the battering ram. Like, I mean, it seems like they're covering their tracks, you know, trying to cover their asses. And but it just it's amazing that they weren't wearing them. But that was by design. You know, I mean, really the state should want that for accountability purposes of their own officers. I mean, we've seen too many of these task force that have been, that go rogue and they steal money, they steal drugs, they resell the drugs. I mean, a couple of years ago, I mean, you had cops in Baltimore, you had cops in New York, you had cops in, you know, here locally in Cleveland, you know, task force across the board, where they were finding out that these cops were basically operating as, you know, organized crime cells in their local cities, where they would go in and they were stealing money, stealing drugs, reselling the drugs, you know, tampering with witnesses and all that other shit. So, I mean, they really should be wearing body cams, especially in these situations where there's going to be drugs and money involved.
Agreed. And again, if their actions were justified, they would have, you know, if it turned out that Kenny Walker, you know, engaged after he knew that they were police and started firing randomly, if I was a cop, I would say, this is why we opened fire. But You can't do that because it's not there. And the only guy who can testify to that that's still alive, meaning Kenny Walker, is in jail and facing life in prison.
Yeah.
But I think...
Yeah. I mean, it feels... I mean, there's also the aspect, you know, talking about all that stuff, there's something about this that just doesn't feel right, right? Like, they weren't wearing body cams. They're going to an apartment that they think that there's drugs and money. The guy was apprehended. I find it amazing that they didn't know that he had already been apprehended. You know, I mean, like, I wonder if there... Who knows? I don't know. I'm just guessing, speculating. This is my own thought. But maybe some of those guys were going there fully with the intention of not all of the money and drugs that they were hoping to find there making it into the evidence locker. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it just... I mean, this is a pretty ugly situation, but anyway, moving on.
Well, and now that it's getting some national attention, hopefully, Breonna Taylor's mother was on MSNBC, and you know, hopefully this will get the light of day that it needs for justice to come to be served. So you were mentioning the fatigue factor, and that was a conversation you and I had before we started recording. When I sent you an article about the potential changes in the Rooney Rule, the NFL rule that requires teams to interview.
Everybody knows what the rule is.
Okay. Well, so the proposed changes to this are to beef up the Rooney Rule, to offer incentives for teams to not just interview minority coaches and coordinators, but to hire them and retain them, and to reward them with draft picks.
I think it rewards their draft position. Like, they can move up in the draft if they hire a black coach. My real initial reaction is I don't fucking care. But you know, once you get past that and you start to look at it and analyze it, I mean, obviously there's going to be some concern about fairness, and you know, this is affirmative action on steroids, and you're going to get all of that. And you know, is it, you know, and so in terms of fair, no, it's not fair, but it's not fair, and life's not fair, and it's something that's unfair to correct something that hasn't been right for a long time. You know, a lot of these owners are, you know, avoiding, you know, they go out of their way to avoid the Rooney Rule. They do things like if they have a black person on staff, they'll interview that person, knowing that that person has no chance in hell of getting the job, or the entire league gets behind one black candidate. Like last year, it was Eric Bieniemy from the Chiefs. Everybody interviews him, and then they pick the guy that they want. That's not a minority, you know, or, you know, what they really hope for is a guy like Ron Rivera, who, you know, he's not black, but I mean, you know, he is a minority, you know, so you can interview him, and, you know, like, there's a better chance, like, you feel more comfortable with hiring him because he fits a little closer into what owners want as coaches. You know, the number, and the reason why it's an issue in the NFL, the number of players, you know, a majority of your players are black, and the majority of the coaches that are coaching them are white. There's a disconnect at times between some of these coaches and some of these players we've seen in the past. But having a black coach doesn't necessarily mean a great fit amongst players. But we've seen black coaches have success in the NFL. Obviously, Mike Tomlin, he's my guy as a Steeler fan. Tony Dungy, you know, Dennis Green had, you know, mixed results. And, you know, but a lot of people, what they'll do is they'll point to the coaches, the black coaches that have failed, and said, well, see, there you go. That's why you can't have a black coach. And it's just like, how many white coaches have failed? You know, I mean, how many white coaches have failed and then been rehired and then been rehired again? You know, I mean, Pat Shurmur has been a head coach in the NFL twice. You know, I mean, he was a failure with the Browns and he was a failure with the Giants. You know, the fact that the coach that Shurmur replaced at the Giants, I can't even remember his name, the fact that that guy even got a chance,
he had, I don't remember who preceded him.
Oh my God, he had the slick back hair.
Yeah.
The New Balance shoes. God, I can't think of his name, but I mean, there've been so many of those guys that have been cycled through the NFL multiple times. I mean, Freddie Kitchens here. I mean, the Browns. There's a litany of guys. I mean, you just go through so many of the guys the Browns hired that have crashed and burned. And you know, a number of those were, you know, recycled. And you know, there's any number of coaches that you can look at that have, I mean, like coaching in the NFL is hard. There's only 32 jobs. You know, everybody's got talent. Everybody's got ideas. It's hard to win Super Bowls. I mean, like, you've only had so many people winning them, right? For the last 20 years, Bill Belichick has won a majority of the Super Bowls, right? Like, so, I mean, like, so statistically, whoever you hire is probably not going to succeed to the, you know, to the ultimate level. It's going to be hard to really break through. You know, so, I mean, there's a lot of guys out there who are, I mean, it took, how long has it taken Andy Reid to win a Super Bowl? And he's been revered as a coach for a long time. So it is a hard profession. It's a hard job. The expectations are very high. So you can't really look at the failure rate and say, see, this is why we can't hire anybody. Because you just need so many things to go right as an NFL coach. So it really comes down to, you know, just giving different people an opportunity because you believe in them and what they bring to the table. And it's just the biggest issue with the NFL is that a majority of the people brought to the table to even be considered are not people who look like the guys that represent your league. And that shouldn't be, you know. And so the argument is, do the owners have that responsibility to hire black coaches, or should they be able to just hire whoever they want because they're rich and they got rich by doing what they thought was right, and they shouldn't have to worry about social justice and social issues? If they're comfortable with hiring white guys that look like them because that's what they're comfortable with, they should be allowed to do it. They shouldn't be forced to do anything just because it makes, you know, obviously the left feel better, and it makes the black players feel better. The black players should just play for whoever's coaching them because they're getting paid a lot of money. That's the counter argument.
Well, it's tough to tell someone that you have to hire someone other. You're a billionaire. You're hiring a guy that's going to pay $5 million a year too.
Who's it tough for? It's not tough for me. Fuck it. And here's why it's not tough for me, because my favorite team is the Steelers. Right? The Rooneys came and said, listen, this is an issue. This is an issue in our league. This is an issue around us. And then after they said it, they fucking put their money where their mouth was and they hired Mike Tomlin. Right? Like, so if they could do it, right, like one of the oldest families in the league, one of the most well-respected families in the league, then I think everybody else can step up and at least listen to it. So now I really don't have a problem with it. And I think that this idea that, well, people are rich, they've made money, they've been successful, so they can't be told what to do. They should be able to do and operate however they want. It seems problematic. Fuck them. Like, you know what? You're going to be held to account, and if you don't like it, you're just going to have to deal with it. I think that we're at a point where we're saying that because people amass a certain amount of money and there's a certain status that they should be able just to be able to run rampant, because if you're successful, then you have to, it's like, rules don't matter to you, right? Like, rules don't apply. And so that's bullshit, right? Like, there should be some social accountability. You should be able to skirt that just because you've amassed some amount of money. Well, do people like it? Do billionaires like it being told what to do? No, they don't like being told what to do. No one likes being told what to do. Jim, you're not a billionaire or a millionaire. You don't like being told what to do at all under any circumstance. I can only imagine what that would be like if you had billions of dollars. But you know what? Fuck you. Sometimes you have to be told what to do. I don't care how much money you make. Like, I mean, that's just the reality. So you know what, NFL owners? You're being told that you need to do something, right? Now, you can fight it and look like racist assholes, or you can just accept it, and maybe you discovered some new talent, and maybe some of you owners who have teams who haven't done shit in terms of making the playoffs or winning anything, you hire a guy like Eric Bieniemy, and who knows, maybe you end up winning and breaking through, right? Instead of hiring fucking Cliff Kingsbury, who didn't win a goddamn thing in college when he was a college coach, but he looks good and he has a great fucking house, right? And he looks good in loafers without socks. Maybe you hire a guy like Eric Bieniemy, who put his time in the league, who's shown that he can put together an offense that can fucking win, and then maybe you go out and win.
Where is he a coordinator now? Is he in Kansas City?
He's in Kansas City still.
Okay. Okay.
He made the rounds. He interviewed here in Cleveland. He interviewed a number of places. And then, surprisingly, he did not get a job.
Well, so the emphasis of the new proposed revisions to the rule.
And then his team went out and won the Super Bowl, by the way.
With an offense that – but a big part of these changes to the Rooney Rule was it used to be only applying to head coaches, and what they're trying to do is say, look, you know, head coaches are often either former head coaches or former offensive or defensive coordinators. I mean, that's kind of like the logical next the next job or previous job for a head coach is typically coordinator, and – the lack of attention given to minorities for coordinator jobs is what the new rule is supposed to address. I think you would agree that the Rooney Rule has had some positive effects, but is not, it has not been as successful as I think the originators of it wanted it to be. And now they're saying they're going to kick it up a notch. Now, yeah. I think it's.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't know what you're going to point to and say that there's been some successes. I mean, I don't think you've ever had
Mike Tomlin, Anthony Lynn.
All right, so you've had black coaches that have been successful. I mean, Mike Tomlin is a direct result of the Rooney Rule. I mean, given the, you know, I mean, the Rooney family and they hired him. But I mean, I think the way the story goes is that the Steelers were all set to hire Russ Grimm as their next head coach. And Mike Tomlin came and blew their nose off, and they said that we have to have this guy. We can't let him leave. And so I don't know if Mike Tomlin was as much the Rooney Rule as he just was that guy that we've seen him be on the sideline, which I need that guy. I mean, like, first of all, Mike Tomlin did an amazing job coaching last year, getting the team to 8-8. And basically, me and you playing quarterback is a feat in and of itself. And hopefully they can do even better this year with Ben coming back. That being said, I mean, I don't know how successful the Rooney Rule has been. You've never had more than five black NFL head coaches at any given time in the league since it's taken place. Again, there's 32 teams. That's not a great ratio. Majority of your players are black. And, you know, there's so many black players that have come through the league that know the game, that have ridiculously high NFL IQs, right, that know the game inside and out, and that aren't just – Michael Jordan types who are super talented and super driven. And so, you know, like, Michael Jordan would be a terrible coach because, like, you can't replicate what that is. But a lot of these guys in the NFL, they put a lot of time into learning the game and mastering, you know, the ins and outs of offense and defenses and different looks and things like that. And they know what good coaching is, that a lot of those guys would be really good on the sideline, but they don't get that opportunity. Where I can take a guy like Peyton Manning, and when Peyton Manning retired, people were like, you could be our head coach, you could be the GM, you can have ownership in the team, where you don't see that happening with a black player, no matter how great they were, and how many great black NFL players have we seen. Just go look at the Hall of Fame.
I'm trying to think of an example of, Eric Bieniemy is obviously the one you brought up. I'm trying to think of any other coordinators that have gotten passed over for head coaching gigs recently. It seemed like you said, everyone interviewed Eric Bieniemy.
There's not a lot. I mean, because there's not a ton of black coordinators in the league, which is also part of the problem, right?
Which is what they're trying to fix with these changes.
Right. It's not all the owners. You can't put it all on the owners. If there's no one for them to interview, right? Or if there's very few people for them to interview, or there's only so some of that stuff needs to be addressed, right? And with the league that has so many black players coming in, and then it's also how many of these black players want to coach? Because it's a grind, constantly looking at film and then going to the combine and, you know, watching college games. And, you know, there is a hierarchy where you got to go and be a scout, and, you know, you have to be able to break down film and figure out if the player has talent, and then, you know, then putting together a game plan, and then also putting together what practices are going to look like, right? And, like, all of that takes time and planning. And being an NFL coach is, I mean, it's a year-round gig. They do get time off, but, I mean, you know, they're under the gun probably, you know, 10, 11 months out of the year.
And they say some of these guys work, like, you know, 15, 18 hour days every day of the regular season.
Yeah, I mean, most of them do. And the guys who don't do well. You know, we saw that Steve Spurrier. I mean, as much as college coaches work, they don't work as near as much as NFL coaches were. And a lot of the college coaches are completely blown out of the water by it. You know, I mean, whether it's, you know, Bobby Petrino or Steve Spurrier or you know, Butch Davis or whoever it might be. I mean, there's a lot that goes into being an NFL coach. You know, it's a big time money organization. There's a lot of responsibilities that have to between the team and the league that have to be resolved. And not to mention the actual, you know, figuring out the X's and O's and winning and losing. It's a hard job that not everybody can do, right? And not everybody is built for it. But when you've got guys who have come up all the way through, you know, little league football, high school, college, the NFL, play a long NFL career, maybe not even a long NFL career, but maybe, you know, long enough to where they're able to get into those roles. Like Byron Leftwich is someone who is, you know, he's a coordinator down in Tampa. He played for the Jaguars, even played for the Steelers a little bit, got us a playoff win once. You know, but now he's a coordinator with Bruce Arians down in Tampa. He's a guy in a, you know, depending on what happens with him and Tom Brady, I wouldn't be surprised if his name starts to make the rounds for those interviews. And the question is, will anyone go ahead and hire him? I that'll be interesting to see.
Well, I mean, we've talked about the Rooney Rule on and off air multiple times. You know, and I've argued at times that it's become such a the owners didn't really take it seriously. So now they're trying to ramp it up and say, well, now you really have to take it seriously. And like I said, they're trying to provide incentives to encourage that. So
yeah, I mean, the only really bad thing about it is that what will make this worse than really what it is that there'll be such a, you know, like things are so politically divided that there'll be a really visceral reaction from your conservative right football fans, your Breitbart fans, your MAGA Trump supporters. Like they're really going to push back against this, talk about how racist it is, and really make a divide. I'm sure that you will see a litany of tweets and social media posts about how they're not, if this rule goes into effect, that they're not going to watch the NFL, blah, 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 yada, yada. Now, it won't affect the NFL. It won't hurt their numbers. Like, these people have tried multiple times to hurt the NFL, again, because a majority of the players are black, and they hate the fact that these black guys make all this money and have the audacity to say and do the things that they do that these people don't like. But the NFL is what it is. It is a fucking monster. It will kill in ratings. It will make shit fuck tons of money no matter how they roll it out this year. And these people will have to eat shit, and that brings me joy.
Okay. So one thing that we smoothly try to add onto our thing to talk about, Rose McGowan came out and said Bill Maher sexually harassed her back in the 90s. And her timing for this was right after his last recorded show for the season. So he kind of gets to go away with that little bit of stink on him, for lack of a better word. And according to Rose McGowan's accusation, he whispered something about, I might not have a great face, but I got, you know, but I was fortunate enough to, you know,
have I don't a have a great dick, face, but I've got a big,
I've got a big dick. Right. Right. Which, not cool. I am back and forth on Bill Maher. Sometimes I think he's a douchebag. Sometimes I do like his show. I do like him as a comic for the most part. But to me, this is, to put this into the same bucket as the other things, you know, I mean, Rose McGowan was at the forefront of the accusations against Harvey Weinstein, where it was literally exposing himself, physically assaulting people, casting couch, just disgusting. And to me, this is not in the same fucking ballpark as that. It's just, if you thought Bill Maher was a pig back in 1992, why not call him out for it then? And, you know, it was a no class remark by a guy who was probably high as a fucking kite. Might be too easy on him?
Yeah, you're being too easy on him. I think that, one, this is, to me, I feel like this is probably something that Bill Maher did. Right? I don't think he's above this. I can't tell you if he did it or not, but I feel like this is right up his alley. And if he were to come out and deny that he said this, I would call bullshit pretty quickly. I'm sorry, I just don't believe it. But at the same time, I think, you know, and also if I were him, what I would do is I would own it, say I did it. And just like, listen, it was the 90s and I was wrong. Obviously, in light of the way things are going now, I would never say or do something like that. It was an asshole thing to do. I shouldn't have put her in that situation and, you know, sweeping under the rug. If I'm a PR guy, that's how I'd handle it. But that being said, you know what? Like, no, it shouldn't be. He also shouldn't get a pass for it because that behavior going unchecked, it can snowball. It can turn into something else, right? Oh, if I can say this, then what else can I say? You know, if I can say, hey, I've got an ugly face, but I got a big dick, you should come back to my room. And then you come back to my room, and it's just like, hey, here's that big dick that I was telling you about. And then, again, she's a young person. She, you know, is trying to make a name for herself. You know, she's trying to brighten her light, brighten her star. Then you have that whole position of power and position of influence. And it's the same thing that Harvey Weinstein said. And it really puts these women in a dangerous situation. And it seems like, well, that's a lot, and you're jumping to conclusions, but that's how this shit happens, right? Like, it starts with a statement, and then it ends with a woman being fucking traumatized with physical assault. So, I mean, is it the worst thing in the world in terms of how all this Me Too things have, how these Me Too, like, does it compare to the shit Harvey Weinstein did or Kevin Spacey or Matt Lauer? No, but it's the sort of thing that emboldens these guys that allows them to continue, that emboldens them, allows them to act the way that they're acting. And eventually that gets worse over time. So, you know, he needs to be held to account. It was a long enough time ago. Who knows how his behavior has been since then? If his behavior is just limited to saying crude shit because he's a comic and comics think that saying crude shit is just allowed because they're being funny, then okay, you know, but if it comes out that, you know, over time his behavior got progressively worse, then that's why, you know, like, this shit really shouldn't be allowed to begin with, you know.
Well, I guess my stance is the accusation that if I take the accusation that she made at 100% face value, I believe it's completely accurate, then I think Bill Maher is guilty of being a douchebag and being inappropriate. But to put that on the same plane as physical assault because it could morph into that, I think that's a bridge too far for me.
She didn't put it on the same plane, though. She said he did it, and it was inappropriate, and it's just like, oh, by the way, you're a pig for this.
Okay.
You know, I mean, you need to be able to look, I mean, like, listen, like, because what you're doing, you're kind of flipping it back on her. Like, well, you're putting this on the same plane as that, and you shouldn't do that, right? So how is she supposed to present it to you that's acceptable to you for her to, like, I mean, she's got every right to put it out there, you know, I mean, and it's disgusting what he said. So how exactly is she supposed to put this in order for you to deem it acceptable?
Do it in the same decade would be my first request. I mean, someone said something to me 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
That doesn't matter.
It matters to me a lot.
Okay, well, it understand matters. This. Did he say it? If he said it, it doesn't matter that she's bringing it up later. Like, I mean, she, like, so what you're doing, it, like, she didn't say it. She didn't bring it up. And we've seen this time and time and time again. These women don't bring this shit up. Like, it happens in Hollywood. They're trying to go this way, right? Sorry that they're, like, they want their careers to continue to go. And these men... we know for a fact these men crush careers over shit like this, right? Like, so she's trying to worry about her career. She brought it up very matter of factly, like, oh, by the way, this is the guy you guys all like. Well, you know, this is shit that he's saying to women, you know, on his set. You know, like, so so you don't like the timing, right? I mean, like,
right.
Like, okay, so how does that put it on the same plane as the shit that happened to me too?
I'm saying it. The headline was Bill Maher, Rose McGowan accuses Bill Maher of sexual harassment. So maybe I'm allowing the headline to distract me like it's intended to do. So it's going to draw clickbait. But
telling someone you've got a big dick who has no interest in your dick, that's sexual harassment. Like that is sexual harassment. Like you can get mad at it, but if you say, like, if you, let me explain this to you before you get yourself in trouble. If you walk into an office, right, and you see a cute girl and you say, hey, I may be round and bald, but I got a big dick, you are going to get fired and you're going to have a suit on your hands. You understand? That's sexual harassment.
I understand, and I'm not defending the behavior. I'm just not putting it in the same category as...
No one is. That's
okay, funny. Okay.
Like,
all right.
It is the definition of it is sexual harassment, right? We agree on that.
Yeah.
What do you mean? Hold on.
Because we don't.
If he said it,
we don't know the context.
Okay. What do you mean we don't know the context? So you think
how
Rose,
do we know that she wasn't flirting with?
So you think Rose McGowan was sitting on his couch in 1993, which would have made her? I don't know. I mean, would have made her
21, 22,
barely 30, 20. Hey. Bill, but I just, come on, man. Like,
all right. Well, all right.
Listen, I get it. Like, you know, I mean, I get what you, I understand your stance on this, but I mean, I just, like, you're just, it's just, I mean, look, it is, like, it's a definition of sexual harassment. It is, right? Like, listen, the rules aren't, like, we don't make the rules in this arena, right? Like, so you don't have a lot of control over it, right? And maybe, you don't like it, but I mean, it is what it is.
Well,
you don't want it to be that way.
All right, I just want to move on because we're not going to come to common ground here, and I want to talk about the other issue.
What is the other issue?
Sextortion.
I don't want to talk about that. No, I mean, I think there's more to talk about here that has more value than that stupid story. So, like, so I want you to make a solid argument about what it is that you've, like, what, so you're literally saying that Rose, so you, like, you won't say it, right? But you're saying that Rose McGowan is basically in the wrong because she took too long to bring this out, and it's too strong of a claim, right? Because if that's not what you're saying, then I need to understand what the point is that you're trying to make.
The point I'm trying to make is that without context, if they were flirting back and forth, which may or may not have been happening, and he would have made a comment that was acceptable at the time, and now she's looking back at it 30 years later and saying, well, he said this, and, you know, after everything I've been through, throw him on the pile with all these other Me Too folks, I have an objection to that.
Okay, I mean, now that's something that you're adding, right? Like, so all we can go off of is what we know. All we have is what we have, right? Obviously, she's not saying that she put that out there. She's not saying that she wanted it. I mean, it was something, the way, like, all we have is her story. And by the way, this has been out here long enough, right? It's not like Bill Maher hasn't heard that she said this. So he could come out and he could try to put this into context, but he's not doing it. And the question is, why? Now, it's not that big of a deal, right? I mean, it was however long ago. Maybe he just doesn't flat out remember, but I have a feeling that he does, right? I mean, like, Bill Maher is a smart enough guy who, I mean, that guy can pull, you know, shit from 30 years ago from when he was at Princeton or wherever he went, or Brown.
Cornell, I think.
He went to one of those Ivy League schools. Like, I mean, he could pull those stories. So I find it hard to believe that he doesn't remember this fucking interaction with her. So, I mean, your boy Bill Maher could come out and defend himself and clear a lot of this up, but he hasn't done so. So I just think that you're putting a lot of shit into this that, like, she's not necessarily putting it on the same plane as Me Too. There's nothing about, like, she's not putting it on the same plane as Harvey Weinstein or any of that other stuff. All she said was, he said this, it's gross. The headline says sexual harassment. By the definition of it, legally, it is sexual harassment, right? Now, so again, like, the time of which that sexual harassment doesn't much matter. Now, if there's an additional fact that there was a conversation going on back and forth, that may change it depending, but someone flirting with you doesn't necessarily give you free range as a man to say, let's talk about my dick, right? I mean, like, that,
I agree, and
once you cross that line, like you need an invitation to cross that line. We don't know if he had it, but to say that, you know, this is like, you know what, like, you're almost it sounds like you're dismissing it because of time frame and because there's a possibility that maybe that there was some heavy flirting going on and maybe she brought this on herself, and now she's misremembering it and changing her story.
Well, I'm not saying she brought this upon herself. I am saying this is, to me, a non-story. If he said something inappropriate 30 years ago, 25 years ago, whatever it was, to bring it up now and to put him in a spot where he has to defend himself about something he may or may not remember having done, and it's, you know, creepy, gross, inappropriate, sure. Yes, you're right. If I walk into my office and start talking to people about my dick, I'm going to get fired, and I should. The one thing I think you're overstating is the quote-unquote power he had over her. She was a guest on his show. It's not like he was, influencing her career. It's not like, it's not a Harvey Weinstein situation where literally people had to weigh their dignity versus their careers. This is a talk show host on a show called Politically Incorrect being gross. And to me, that's where it ends. And the fact that we're hearing about it in 2020, when it happened in 1990, whatever, I think is just something you...
opportunistic.
It should not be a story. Well, I mean, look, Rose McGowan is an actress I like. She was in the original Scream. So I'm a fan of hers. If every time anyone said something back in the 90s can now come out and become a headline, it's where are we going to go as a society? I agree. It should not have been appropriate. It's inappropriate then.
But again, look, she's calling out a bad behavior. I don't think it's the end of the world. It's a headline. It's a story. I don't think it's going to be the thing that it's not going to topple Bill Maher. They're not going to cancel the show. He's not going to lose a paycheck. Probably you're not going to lose a night of sleep. Right, it's calling him out for some bullshit that he said. If anything, it's a story. It's one of those things. Like, listen, for men, watch what you say. Right. Yep. I think there's a little bit of a, the media is going to blow. Like, they're going to try to spin the headlines to draw people in for the clickbait factor. But the reality is, what's going to happen with this is probably nothing. Again, it won't impact Bill Maher. She's not talking about suing him. She's not talking about criminal charges. All that stuff is dead and gone. I think it's just, a call. You know, if you're a young guy in entertainment and you've got a talk show or something along those lines, just watch what you say to the guest. I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. She's calling him out. Maybe he said something about her on his show that was maybe misplaced, and I don't know, but who knows? So maybe she's just like, popping kettle or something along those lines. Like, you're putting a lot of negativity towards her, and that's not the best, right? I'm just saying it's a bad look for you.
I'm sure I'll hear about it on Twitter, and again, I just think that everything gets thrown into one bucket. That's the vibe I get for things like this. And to put it even on par with what Joe Biden has been accused of, and I don't want to go down that road, although I've read some more about that story, and it just gets weirder and weirder.
Yeah, the victim of the Tara Reid chick, so there's some issues with hers. But anyway, I got to go.
Okay.
Tell them where they can find
us. At Whiskey Congress on Instagram and Twitter. Jim at WhiskeyCongress.com if you want to email me and tell me what a bad person I am. Steve at WhiskeyCongress.com if you want to email him.
How great he is.
Tell Steve how great he is, because that's, I'm sure, what you want to do. Anyway, good talking to you, man. Stay safe, and we'll talk again soon.
All right.
Later. All right, now I have to not fuck this up.